Okay, once again, welcome all. And we've got what looks like a pretty full agenda. We should have some time for additional material if anybody has other questions that they want to pose in the chat or audibly after we go through the agenda for tonight. And with that, Alan, take it away. And you have to unmute yourself.
Just did. Okay, thank you very much, Chris, and good evening, everyone. As Chris says, we've got a whole bunch of stuff, so let's get right to it. And the first thing we have is a follow-up from Chris himself.
Yeah, this was kind of interesting. Image Resizer is one of the Microsoft Power Toys for Windows 10. Really, really good collection of utilities that extend capabilities within Windows 10. One of them is Image Resizer, and it is a really fantastic, easy-to-use utility for resizing JPEGs. And so you can, it comes with some preset sizes, and you can define your own. You can define the quality that you want them to go out to by default. You can adjust that as it goes and so forth. They're really nice, except I ran into a bug back in February. Where JPEGs that came from, that originated as Nikon RAW files and got processed by just about anything to a JPEG, when I tried to do an image resize on it, it would come up with this error message, which was a slide that was in the March 3rd Q&A. So it would say that unspecified property type or value, and it can't resize the picture. So I reported that to the dev team on February 24th, and within hours, I had a reply from one of the developers saying they were able to reproduce the error, and guess what? They fixed it yesterday. So it took them a little while to get around to it. Their first approach that they were going to do was just strip EXIF information from JPEGs. And those tags are things like camera data, the camera manufacturer, the lens manufacturer, the model, exposure information, and various things like that. Now, I replied that and they said that the bug was actually coming from invalid data in some EXIF tags. And so their first approach was going to be just strip all the EXIF tags. And I said, well, fine if you want to do that, but I'll never use the program if you do that because there's a lot of valuable information that I want left in those tags. So they eventually fixed it by checking each of the EXIF tags and removing any that would cause a failure, and then writing out the rest of them. So it works, but I found that some of the EXIF tags did get written out, but with incorrect information. One I found really odd, an image width tag of 358,285,312. That's a pretty big picture. Yeah, they do have some work. It's still a work in progress in terms of that. I bugged that one today, and they actually admitted that, oh, yeah, we got a problem there. And so they are going to be revisiting some of these tags to see if they can do a better job. Fortunately for me, all of the tags that were important for my use were intact. So the camera, make and model, the lens, make and model, all of the exposure information, shutter speed, aperture, and ISO, the focal length of the lens, exposure mode I was in, aperture priority, shutter priority, whatever, GPS coordinates, copyright information I have in there, date stamps, and so forth. So it's good enough for me. It is, so it's fixed in PowerToys 0.5.1.0, which was released yesterday, and I will paste into the chat window where you can get the releases for that if you want the PowerToys. So I highly recommend them. I think that they are a really great set of utilities, and the developers are very, very responsive, even if it takes them 9 months sometimes to fix problems.
Interesting. Okay, so the next thing we have is a share on an app that we've talked about previously, but Chris has found some interesting uses for it.
Yeah, this one came out. I knew about Free File Sync. I mean, Alan is a big proponent of this, and he uses it quite extensively. And I use other utilities that provide me with functionality that I saw in Free File Sync. So I didn't need another utility to do something that I was quite happy with file history built into Windows 10. But I knew it was there. And this recently came up where the I'll paste into the chat in a minute. This recently came up when the website we wanted to do an offsite backup outside of the control of the our ISP and our web hoster. And so we were looking for the ability to back up files from the website. So it is used most frequently when it's doing backups to local drives, but it actually has a couple of extra capabilities in there that I found kind of intriguing, that you can actually sync between your computer and online storage. The two forms of online storage are FTP servers, which are very commonly used for anybody who is hosting websites, and Google Drive as well. So next. Okay, so the first one was backing up files that exist on an FTP server. So this, again, goes back to our website, which is hosted, or the files are accessible through an FTP server. And if you use an FTP client to back up all of those files on there, basically you can copy everything every time you want to make a backup copy. There's no practical way to just look and see what files have changed or are new on the server. So the easiest thing is to back up everything every time you want to do it. Well, for the for our website, that's 4,478 files, 6 gigabytes, and it took over 30 minutes on my relatively fast connection. Primarily, it would have been done a lot faster, except there's a lot of tiny files, and the way FTP works, tiny files take a long time to do. And you'd have to do that every time. So with Free File Sync, the first time you have to copy everything. So you have all of those files, 6 gigabytes, and then for me it ran in just under 30 minutes. And then subsequent runs of Free File Sync, it takes 12 seconds to look for new or changed files, and then a couple of minutes or less to actually copy down those new or changed files. So a dramatic difference in the amount of time it takes. And I don't, you know, I don't have to worry about whether it's catching everything. It just does its job, finds all of those new files and copies them down really quick and slick. So here's an example of using Free File Sync. So in here, basically you have the two panels, the left-hand panel underneath where it says compare, and then the right-hand panel underneath where it says synchronize. So you have your source on the left and your destination is on the right. Next.
Just out of interest, Chris, you can simplify the screen if you cross out configuration and overview.
That's true. Yes, sorry. I should have done that just to simplify it. So in this case, because we're not using local drives, rather than just typing in those boxes or using the browse button to find a local directory to copy from and to, what you do is you click on that cloud icon, and then it comes up with a dialog box where you can choose from either Google Drive, secure FTP, or regular FTP. And you go in this case, it's an FTP server, so you just put in all your particulars of your username, your password, the directory that you want to back up, and basically that's it. You do that, it sets up the connection, and it'll save that information for you. Then on the right-hand side, under the synchronization setting, I'm highlighting that you click on there and you say what it is you want Free File Sync to do. You can have a two-way synchronization, but in this case, what we're interested in doing is just mirroring the contents of the website to a local drive. So we choose the mirror option and it basically does what we want with a little bit of an addition. Next.
Tom is asking if Free File Sync goes the other way too, and I think you just said that yes, it goes both ways if you wish.
Yeah, you can set up under custom. You can have all kinds of weird, wonderful rules on the way that files get synchronized.
And he also points out that Free File Sync is actually a multi-platform open source program, so it works on Linux and Mac.
Yeah, really nice for that.
As well as Linux.
So, another thing is, like, if you notice the last green icon in the mirror section there, it has a trash can and it's a minus sign on it. What that is saying is if I find a file on the local copy of my backup copy that doesn't exist on the web server, just delete it. So it is creating an absolute mirror copy. But I decided, well, it also has some synchronizing or some what do they call versioning. So rather than throwing it in the trash, what I can do is if there's some file that no longer exists on the web server, rather than just deleting it, move it somewhere else. So I defined a new directory, Z, OPCUG website backup versions, and it'll copy it in, and it'll actually have the file name with a date stamp as part of the file name. And I set it to keep a maximum of 4 copies, and that way if a file gets deleted and somebody says, oh, I didn't mean to delete that file, we actually have a backup copy of it if I've run the backup in a reasonable time frame or whatever. So really, really slick way of being able to back up the FTP server. So next. Okay, so then what you do is I have on the left-hand side the FTP site, and I've just blurred out my credentials and that. And then on the right-hand side is where I want to back it up to. So on drive Z, OPCUG web backup, / OPCUG.ca. Then I click on the compare button, and it goes out. And in the first run, it's actually, you'll see like it's completely selected on the left. There's nothing listed on the right. And at the bottom, there's a summary. So there's 4,609 files that exist on the web server that don't exist on my local drive. And it tells me in the bottom corner that it's going to be 5.97 gigabytes in those files. So when you click on the actual synchronize button, then it first off comes up with the little box on the left saying, do you want to do this? It's the last summary of what's actually going to happen to it. And you click on the start, and then the other box will appear, which gives you progress as it's going by. So it'll tell you how much has been transferred, how long it's estimated to take, and all like that through till the end of it. So you let that run for, in this case, the first run was a half hour, and away you go. A later run that I did on it, after its 12 seconds, it found one file that existed on the web server that didn't exist on the local drive. So it's going to happily copy that over, and it's only a 2.97 megabyte file, so it's done in like under a second. So really, really slick way of being able to keep a backup mirror copy of an FTP server. So next. So the other one that it can do that interested me was it can actually do a backup of Google Drives. And so this is if you don't want to use Google Drive for desktop synchronization program, which I think is the slickest way of doing things. Now, if you're on a Linux platform, I don't think they have Google Drive for desktop for Linux. So this is a way that you could do a backup of your Google Drive on a Linux platform. But it also works on the PC. So in a web browser, if you wanted to back up a Google Drive, what you would do is you'd right-click on a file or folder on your Google Drive in a web browser. You choose the option in the context menu that pops up saying download. Unfortunately, there's no practical way to get just new or changed files, and it is tedious beyond description, especially if you have a lot of folders that are on your Google Drive, which I tend to do. And the OPCUG has a team drive, which is actually a Google Drive that we use for managing the files belonging to the user group, and it has lots of folders. So if you use Free File Sync, the first time it's going to copy everything, but you know, you just point to the Google Drive and it just does everything. It does, you don't have to go folder by folder, but it's going to take however long it's going to take. Subsequently, it'll take seconds or less to check for new or changed files, and then a couple of minutes or less to get new or changed files. And again, you don't have to hunt for them. It will figure out what needs to be backed up. So in this case here, we go again to the cloud icon. And in this case, we choose Google Drive, and it'll ask you to add a connection. And basically, you just add in your credentials to your Google Drive. So in my case here, it's chris.taylor@opcug.ca. It asks for my password. It has a verification code sent to my email so that I have to verify that, yes, this really is me. Yes, I really do intend to have this happen and so forth. And you can see on the right-hand side, I actually have two set up. I have BOD, which is the team drive for the AutoPC user group, as well as my drive, which is my personal Google Drive. So once I select that, then again, I go into the synchronization and I set it up as a mirror. So basically exactly the same way as I had it for backing up the FTP server. The only difference is in the next build, We have, if rather than deleting files, if we have a file that no longer exists on the Google Drive, I move it to a different backup folder. So in this case, /team drive/team drive archive. And again, I'm keeping a maximum of 4 copies. So again, if somebody accidentally deletes a file, well, if they just delete it, there is a trash can that's good for 30 days. But if it disappears completely, I'll be able to keep older versions of files for a period of time quite easily. So backing up the OPCUD team drive, which is just a Google Drive, using a web browser, it was 1,319 files, 1.2 gigabytes. Very tedious selecting the folders, very error prone if I happen to miss the, you know, somebody created a new file buried deep within the structure or something like that, I might miss it. So I was doing monthly backups and this was really, really tedious. Or I could just download all the folders all the time, but that would take at least 30 minutes of my time. And with free file sync, first time, yeah, it's going to take that amount of time, but subsequently, it just takes seconds to check for new or changed files and a couple of minutes or less to get new or changed files. So really, really slick way. There is one problem with Google Drive using Free File Sync, and that's that it can't pick up Google Docs type files. So Google Docs are those files like word processing, spreadsheets, and presentation material, and they are the Google format. They show up as 0-byte files on Google Drive because Google doesn't charge against your quota. And so it just shows up as 0-byte files. And if you do download them using their facilities, right-clicking on the file and choose download, it'll actually convert it to one of the Microsoft formats and then download that file. Free File Sync can't transfer them, and the APIs just don't allow them to, say, convert the file and then download it. The APIs just aren't there, the application programming interface. So there's just no way for Free File Sync to actually grab those files. So if you are using those, you'll just get errors on those. You can just do it, ignore it all. All of those files will not be part of the backup set. For the PC user group, any of the Google Docs, I asked people, I converted them to the Microsoft format. And then I asked the board members to not use Google Docs type formats and to just use the regular Microsoft formats on all of the files that they post there. So I don't think that'll be too bad. We had, I think, 8 Google Drive type Google Docs format files on the drive. And so once I got rid of those, it's running really, really slick.
Okay, thanks, Chris. That was a really quick introduction to a very complicated way to use Free File Sync, but I think it illustrates the point that it's a really powerful program. It can do a whole bunch of things. And even if you're not trying to back up the OPCUG website, you may have an application that can use some of that functionality that Chris has just talked about. There was one question that Tom raised. He's asking if Free File Sync uses both date and timestamps and file size or a hash of the files. And the answer is it's configurable. When you do the compare, you're allowed to choose either the time and size or the contents of the file. Clearly, if you choose contents of the file, it takes a lot longer because it has to search through the file to make sure it's different. So I typically just use date and timestamp and don't worry about it.
Yeah, for the uses that I mentioned, we just did it by the file name and the date and time.
Yeah. And I think that's the simplest and it works pretty well for most situations. Although it can actually be quite useful just to toggle on the file content and what I sometimes do is I'll actually copy all the files over and then I'll run content and just make sure that they're all still the same. It hasn't
been. Oh, that's a good idea. I noticed one thing in going back in the chat too, Tom mentioned that EarthView can do batch resizing rather than just the resizer in the PowerToys. There's nothing faster than the PowerToy. I can guarantee you that. Right click on a JPEG, choose resize it, click OK, and you're done. It's really, really slick. And you can do multiple files selected and do conversion or resizing of them all at once. So really, really nice.
Does the resize go either way, up and down?
You can tell it, yes, it can. There is a checkbox in there saying that don't make a file bigger. So if you are accidentally, or if you're choosing a bunch of files, that you can opt to, yes, size it up. And I've never tried it to see how good a job it does, but it can, or you can actually prevent it from you know, going ahead and doing that if you wanted to.
And there's a custom size setting, is there not, Chris? So yep. You can set it to any size.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay, moving along then, it's time to look at switching away from Windows to good old Linux. And we've been doing this for a while now, and we've looked at a number of different Windows programs, which I hope people might find some of the Windows apps useful. But now we're getting into the nitty-gritty in terms of what works on Linux and what doesn't. So tonight we're going to look at the a program called the Home Site, which is the HTML editor that I use for developing web pages. And this is Home Site. Home Site's a really old program. It was originally produced by a company called Allaire. It got sold out to whoever makes Dreamweaver. It was integrated into Dreamweaver Macromedia. And then eventually they dropped it in favor of their own application. But I actually own HomeSite. I actually bought this probably 30 years ago. And I've been using it ever since. And I really like it. It works very well for me. I don't need anything updated. I only use it in simple formats. And it works really well. And so this is HomeSite running on Windows. And the beauty of it is I set it up so I have two tabs. So if I hit the edit tab and I've opened the file, it will actually show me the source code. And this is an editor, so I can edit it. I can add paragraphs and tags and no break spaces and that kind of thing. And I can add tables and all kinds of wonderful things. So it's quite a powerful editor specific to HTML. And then if I want to see how I'm doing, I can hit the Browse tab, and it will give me a browser-type view of the file. So that's typically the way that I use this thing. Now, it's a Linux application. It's a Windows application. There's no Linux version of HomeSite. As I say, it was deprecated quite a while ago. Now, of course, there are Linux-based HTML editors out there, and one of the ones that's touted as being very good is this thing called SeaMonkey. And it turns out SeaMonkey is actually a browser, but it has a composer module built into it. And if you play around a bit, you can load the composer module. It will let you open a file using this icon up here. And again, if you click on the HTML source tag, you see, and you can edit the actual HTML tags. Or if you hit the normal mode over here, then it will show you the browser view. And so that is a possibility to use a different application. But again, I really like HomeSite. I've been using it for 30 years, and if I don't have to change, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So what can we do? Well, when we have a Windows-only application, one of the possibilities is to run it under a program called Wine. And Wine, it's one of these, I've talked about Wine previously, I'm sure. Wine is one of these Unix-type acronyms. They love these things. Wine is not an emulator. So it doesn't run as an emulation package. What it does is it intercepts the Windows API calls and translates them into POSIX, which is the Linux command terminology. So it's a kind of a translation layer between the Windows program and the Linux operating system. The latest release down here is version 6 for what it's worth. And what you can do though is you can search for a program name. So I'm asking for HomeSite, and what that does is it brings up a database. And if the program's in the database, then it will give you all the reviews that people have entered. So you can see here that somebody has reviewed HomeSite version 5.5, which is actually a later version than I have. I only have up to something like 4.1. And he's given it a bronze rating. So it's not silver or gold or platinum, but it works to some extent. We can look at the frequently asked questions, and there's lots of information on what to do with Wine. One of the things is, how do I install Wine? And it will tell you that you can download a dev package for Ubuntu type Linux distributions, and you can install that, and then you will have Wine available on your Linux system. But we know from previous sessions in this switching from Windows thing that we also have a Linux software manager, and lo and behold, there is a version of Wine available in software manager, and we know that if we click on install, then it will just simply install Wine in Linux. Now, it turns out, he says, drinking his beer as we go along, it turns out that there's no GUI type way to install Windows programs. So what you need to do is run the command window, which Linux calls the terminal. And if you do a list, an ls, which is like a dir in DOS, you list the files in the current folder, you'll find a program called setup.exe inside my home site directory on this flash drive. So the Windows installation program is called setup.exe to install HomeSite. So what I do then is I issue a command. I just say wine setup.exe, and that runs the setup program. And basically, once you do that, it's essentially a Windows install. And this is the window that pops up in Windows. It pops up in Linux. I choose to install HomeSite 3 right here. And what it does is I've got a wine menu category because I've installed Wine, and it drops HomeSite 3 into this Wine menu item. So I can launch HomeSite by simply clicking on HomeSite 3.0. And you'll notice also that I've updated HomeSite 3 to HomeSite 4. So I'm running my current version. So now when I run one of those HomeSite programs, you can see that now I'm running HomeSite on my Linux box. And you can tell that because if you look in the tree directory over here, you can see that the tree directory is pointing to media data disk. And that's not a Windows type drive. It's not D colon something or other. It's actually slash media slash data disk, which is a Linux mount point. So we're actually looking at my data drive, which is a data partition, as a Linux mount point. And in data disk, there's all kinds of HTML files. And here I picked up one called linux.htm. And you can see that I've got the code displayed there. And again, if I hit this browse tab up here, then I see my menu of Linux type websites available to me in HomeSite. So there's an example of a Windows program, a Windows only program that I can run on my Linux system using this Wine program. Now, that's not to say that you can take every Windows program and run it on Wine in Linux. Unfortunately, life doesn't work quite like that. But I know that HomeSite works really well, so I'm allowed to put a big green check mark next to HomeSite And next time, we'll move along down the list and see how we do with some other Windows apps. And Tom, I see, is saying that Wine is very small. Could be. Okay, was there anything else in the chat, Chris?
Nothing I've been seeing. There's something about different code editors, things like that, but nothing specifically about what you were talking about.
Yeah, there's all kinds of HTML editors available. Now, as I say, it's just that, you know, you get used to using Windows programs, and if you can use it in Linux, why not? If it works, that's my easy to solution.
Yeah, for sure.
Next up then is a question, and it's actually a question from me. I've been working with a colleague of mine on a Python programming project. It's actually a neat project. What we're trying to do is convert thousands of PDF files to text files, and then search through those text files for specific variables. And the way to do that is to use Python, because there's a module in Python called PDF Miner, which gives you the capability of converting a PDF file to text, and then you can use a search module to find various bits and pieces and identify the things you want. The problem is, I develop a Python program, which is essentially a script file. It ends up as a something.py. I send it to him by email as an attachment, and he's using Microsoft Outlook, and it blocks all the PY attachments, so he can't open them. So my question was, is there a setting in Outlook that will stop it blocking PY script files? And in the meantime, my other solution, rather than just send them by email, is to use Dropbox. And I typically use Dropbox as a file transfer system for huge files that can't be sent by email. But quite equally well, I can use it to send any files or share a folder with people and share files that way. Anyway, my question was, can Outlook be stopped from blocking certain files? And it turns out Chris knows all about this.
Well, I know a little bit about it because I help run the email system for Natural Resources Canada, so I'm painfully aware of what Outlook is doing when it's blocking file attachments. And it is a security issue. It's blocking EXEs and scripts and all kinds of things that potentially could hold dangerous content if people double-click on it, which in an organization with about 4,200 people, almost inevitably, if malware was coming in that didn't get caught by the antivirus system, somebody would double-click it and infect the machine. Now, there are some options, so you can actually go, and I pasted that into the chat, you can actually go in and you can unblock any particular file types you want to allow through. The easiest I found is to rename the files. Now, the PY files, they're just text files, and Outlook can't tell that they're a script other than it has a PY extension. So you could rename it to something like, if you have script.py, you have a script.py.txt or something like that, and then you just tell the person remove the .txt at the end, and they've got their PY file. That wasn't all that practical for Alan because he had so many files that he had to deal with. So you could also zip the files. And so the problem with that is that some email systems, their antivirus components and that in the mail system would actually look inside the zip files. And then they would see .py files and remove them from the zip file. So then I took to encrypting the zip files so they couldn't do that. But then some email systems decided, well, if it's an encrypted zip file, they can't go in, look at what's in the contents of that zip file. So they just block the whole zip file. So there's lots of cat and mouse type back and forth in terms of trying to allow or disallow particular file types. So if anybody really wants to do it, I really suggest the link at the top. It goes through with the different versions of Outlook, what you have to do to unblock particular file types. I see Tom actually recommended using Pegasus Mail. I think most people would agree that changing mail systems is a non-trivial action to take. And so Alan's approach of just saying, rather than mailing it, you know, just put it on Dropbox or any other file sharing system, or, you know, potentially renaming them to .txt or something like that, or going through the official supported method of actually not blocking particular file types is probably easier than changing mail systems.
Yeah, I did the .txt thing for a while, but you have to do it to every file. It's just a pain.
Yeah.
Now, Tristan actually has just posted an interesting option using a free GitHub account because we're sharing code. And you can create private repositories if you wish to do so.
Interesting.
I guess that's a bit like using Dropbox. The neat thing about Dropbox is this friend and I, we already have a Dropbox folder which we share. So it's just easy to copy the file or upload the files to Dropbox, and then he can download them.
Yeah, so you really have to. If you have to share files on an ongoing basis, setting it up on a file share like Google Drive or Dropbox or any of those, and sharing a folder is great. Alan and I do that for QA material, and he has a folder on his Dropbox called opcug that he shared with me, and we just drop files back and forth on there, and it's a really, really slick way of being able to share files between multiple people.
Okay, so our next question that came in was about an old router, Chris.
Yeah, so we got a question come in. Somebody said their Bell router is 40 years old. Now, that would put it before the official birth of the internet, so I don't think it's 40 years old. But the question was, should they ask Bell to provide a new router that is less susceptible to being hacked? And the answer is yes. If that's not strong enough, yes. Yes. So if you have an old router like that, it's probably really due to be replaced with something that's a little bit more modern. And if you look at the Bell's own instructions regarding security on the old, this not 40-year-old, but ancient router, they use the two-wire router modem, and they say, first off, make sure wireless security is enabled, and then you select the authentication type that you want. And notice that the default is web-open. Now, I'm not exactly sure what web-open means. Web is not really open. Open usually implies there's no password at all on it, but at any rate, it is, you know, using web of some description, so wired equivalent privacy. Web is useless. It can be cracked in seconds by anybody sniffing the airways. A saying that I use whenever I'm giving my presentation on securing home wireless is that web might stop your neighbor, but it won't stop your neighbor's kid. It's really trivial to download a program like WebCrack or something like that that can crack web. So definitely the very fact that their two-wire modems were defaulting to such a useless piece of so-called security, definitely this is not a modem that you really want to be using in nowadays. So, next slide. So, two-wire doesn't even exist anymore. It was founded in 1998, and it was bought by a UK company called Pace PLC in 2010. I seriously doubt any security patches will ever be provided for that device, as security issues may pop up on the device. So definitely you want to replace it. But, you know, my thought was, well, this is, you know, will Bell replace this for free and so forth? So I decided, well, I'll call them up. So I called up Bell. And I talked to the tech people. They said that definitely they will replace it for free. It does not require a change to your internet plan. So if you're happy with your internet plan, what you're paying and so forth, then you can stick with that. It will require no wiring changes in your house. So basically it would just be they'll ship you, you know, a replacement device. You follow the instructions to set it up, and you're off to the races. It will open up some other options. So their latest home, whatever it is, Home 2000 or Home 4000 device, it will do speeds up to 1.5 gigabit per second. You know, so you definitely never get anywhere close to that with a two wire, even if you're willing to pay for it. So, higher price on some of their plans for sure, but it does open up options for things like higher speeds and so forth. And if you want to take advantage of this, just contact Bell at their number, 310 Bell, and, they can get you set up with a more modern device. So highly, highly recommended that you actually do get rid of that ancient device and upgrade.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And I just noticed Tristan has put a couple of posts in the chat window. He says, here's an example of sharing personal code in GitHub, if you're curious. And I'm happy to help others get started if they wish. So if you have any interest in GitHub, then there's a possibility for you.
Tom mentions maybe they'll offer special prices with the new router. The router itself, they will just swap it out, so it won't cost you anything. They'll swap it for a new one, and they own that device. But in terms of whether you can actually, you know, negotiate other things on your plan at the same time, entirely possible, I suppose. So by all means, fill your boots. Whenever I'm talking to an ISP, I always beat up on them on price and say, you know, I'm happy with your service, but I want a better price. And almost inevitably, I do end up getting better price. Stu, I'm going to mute you. We got a little bit of background noise.
Now, Stuart's coming up next, though.
Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry.
Well, just before we do that, that's actually suggests a question to me. In my neighborhood, they're just installing fiber. This is Bell. So my question to everybody is, when they install fiber in your neighborhood, did they offer you a deal? Because I might be interested in that. Anyway, we'll come back to that later on. So the next thing is, as you've noticed, Chris and I often share programs that we find useful and we hope that you find them useful. But it doesn't always have to be us that finds the programs and talks about them. So if you have an application for Android, or it can also be a Windows program on PC, you can always tell us about it and share the information with everybody on the call. One of the things I thought quite a while ago was the fact that CRTC was forcing the telcos to implement some software that will stop robocalling and spam phone calls and that kind of thing. This fairly recent article in the Toronto Star says that it won't have immediate effects. So the next share is from Stuart, and he's got an app for Android that can help you before the government takes over our phones. Okay, Stuart, now you have to unmute yourself.
Sorry, Sue.
Well, I don't really have an app myself because I have no use for the thing. Truecaller came across my view a little while ago, and it seems to be an incredibly popular and well-established application for Android. And I have no need for it because I don't talk as much as many people do, but well, I keep stumbling across reviews and mentions of it as being one of the most ancient and established applications for controlling your phone and SMS information coming across Android. So honestly, all I can say is check it out if you're one of those people who talk a lot. And if you have problems with spam and SMS information control, because I can't reference it other than saying it's apparently a very good program. Next.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Android updates. In my stumbling through Google searches for updates on various things, I came across this forum on Telus. And once a week, somebody updates this little list of which devices are going to get an update. It's not necessarily accurate. As an example, according to the list there, the my wife's phone was supposed to get a security update tomorrow, but it got it yesterday. So, yeah, what the hell? But if you're anxious about what's going on with updates and security for your phone, this forum indicates when Telus is supposed to release their updates. Now, I know all of the Canadian carriers are extremely competitive and insist that they are working on their own, but they already release their updates at the same time. So whether it's Rogers or Virgin or Bell or Telus or even Videotron or the even the other regional carriers, you're all going to get the update at about the same time, give or take a few days. So this is a way of checking out when stuff's going to happen.
Okay, thanks very much, Stuart. That's a useful link, I guess. It doesn't help those of us who are not with the big telcos and have a custom ROM, I guess, but we get updates anyway.
You roll your own. You smoke your own.
Okay, the next share is actually from Tom, but I don't know whether Tom's going to talk about it or Chris.
Well, Tom posted this to the member forum the other day, and I thought it was interesting enough that I put together a couple of slides on the issue. So Microsoft Edge, Microsoft added some what they call strict security mitigation options into the Edge browser. And it's off by default, and they haven't really talked a lot about it. It actually started back in August, but they had it in some of the early builds of Edge. But now it's in the mainstream build that has gone out to everybody just very recently, the last couple of days. They claim it adds security mitigations for all sites. Parts of sites might not work properly, and they warn you about that. And they say it blocks security threats. What it does is it actually disables the Chromium just-in-time compiler. And apparently this is widely abused, and there's been a lot of bugs in the just-in-time compiler, and the attackers have learned about it and are actively exploiting these bugs in the compiler. It also enables, at the same time, the Intel's control flow enforcement technology, which I have no clue what it's all about or anything like that. It was released in Edge version, as you see there. And Microsoft claims that the reduction in the attack surface kills half the bugs that's seen in exploits in that just-in-time compiler, and every remaining bug becomes more difficult to exploit. So it sounds like it's pretty impressive what it'll do. The one thing that might be a gotcha is parts of sites might not work. So next. So it is off by default. To turn it on, you can click on the three dots in the top right-hand corner and go to Settings. On the left-hand side, you choose Privacy, Search, and Services, and then you scroll down to the Security section. And then there's a toggle for Enable Security Mitigations for a More Secure Browsing Experience. And as I said, it's off by default. You just click on it to turn it on, and then you choose either I forget what they call the non-strict, the regular or whatever. You click on the strict one, and then it is in effect immediately. If you find that some sites that you trust are broken by turning on that feature, you can add exceptions to the list. So you could add, you know, https://opcug.ca, for example. The details at the URL that I posted in there, it's pretty techy. So if you want the nitty gritty of what is going on, it's an older posting. It's from back when Edge just had it as a developer preview, and you had to go in and do special things to turn on this particular feature. So you can ignore the instructions on how to turn it on. Just go with the simple method of turning it on. But I would be actually interested to know, and I just found out about this when Tom posted this today, I would be interested in knowing, perhaps next week, how many people have turned it on, and have you had any sites that broke because of it? So I turned it on, but Edge isn't my primary browser. I use it for some things, and I will keep track of if it actually causes me any issues. But I'd be sort of interested to know going forward if anybody feels that there's too much stuff that gets broken by it, or whether they think that it's a perfectly sane thing to do.
Anybody have any comments on that?
Tristan has a comment. Edge is getting Microsoft into hot water. They just started adding a feature to integrate loans for online purchases. Yeah, I heard about that. Not only that, they're in Windows 11. They're making it extremely difficult for, as we talked about last week, for anybody to make their default browser anything other than Edge. I think they're going to have some regulatory bodies around the world that are going to make them back up on that a little bit.
Yeah, Tristan also had a comment earlier about spam phone calls. He said he got a few this week. Apparently, my social insurance number has been revoked. And there were some comments about Bell Fiber. Martin says he lives in Orleans and Bell's installing fiber right now. They haven't been any offers, but maybe when they finish doing the install. Lawrence says Bell Fiber, no deal and no marketing.
My experience with both Bell and Rogers, I don't have any experience with other ISPs really, is that you can beat up on them on price a little bit. I never go in you know, mad and angry at them or anything like that. I'll always say, I'm really happy with your service. I'm not about to change to somebody else, but I've been a long-time customer, and I think I deserve a better deal. And I got a fantastic deal through Rogers. And I've been really, really happy with them. The last time I talked to them, I guess it was when I moved over to their higher speed service, and they gave me 1 year of $25 off per month. And so that ran out, and then I called them, and the people I talked to that were obviously in Southeast Asia somewhere said, oh, no, there's nothing we can do. So I said, well, I'd like to speak to the loyalty department. And they said, oh, they can't do anything for you better than I can do. And they were willing to offer me, you know, half price on movie network or things like that. And I just said, no, I want to talk to the loyalty department. And I got hold of the loyalty department. They're actually out on the East Coast somewhere. And the guy said, well, sorry, I can't give you $25 off a month, but I can give you $30 off a month. So I said, oh, okay.
No, we can't do that.
Yeah. So I've got that for a year. And in another 10 months when it comes due again, I'll just call them up again and I'll say, I want to speak to the loyalty department, and I'll go through the same spiel. I don't mind doing it once a year. You know, if it provides me with those sort of savings. Linda is with Bell, and she was paying for her landline, internet, TV. She was paying up around $200 or something like that. And I said, that's insane. You know, so I called up, and I got it knocked down about $40 a month off of her bill. And this was not a one-year thing. This was like a, you know, permanent change until they up the rates again and so forth. So I highly recommend that if you think you're paying too much for your ISP, call them up and just say, you know, I'm happy with the service, but I want a better price.
Hey, Chris, you can come out to my house. I got beer and you can develop.
Now, one of the things on this, I am a long-term customer. So I've been a customer of Rogers for TV for like 35 years. I wasn't a customer of theirs for internet access or landline, but I got those at that same time. And Linda was a long-term customer of Bell. She was with Bell for well over 10 years. So I don't know how much that counts for, but certainly Rogers, it's the loyalty department that I'm talking to. And so they do seem to care that, you know, I've been a long-term customer of theirs. So it's always worth trying.
And Tristan made a comment, just be careful with the Bell marketing, because only Bell Pure Fiber is true fiber optic right to your home.
Yeah.
But I think that's what they're basically installing right now. They seem to be installing new cables everywhere. So we're at that point. There's a whole bunch of new messages in the chat window that I haven't looked at yet. But we're at that point. If anybody has any other questions, then we can take those. So either probably open your microphone and talk, because I don't know about Chris, but I'm going through the chat window right now.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. I have a question. It's Lawrence. The question is Ease Us Backup.
Right? Yeah. Ease Us to do backup. Yeah.
Ease Us to do backup. If I want to set up a backup solution that would only backup certain files or exclude certain files. Is that possible?
Yes, definitely. The ability to exclude can't be done with the free version, but all of the paid versions do have the ability to exclude files. Even the free version, I believe, can do file backups as opposed to image backups. So definitely the cheapest of their paid versions could do everything that you, you're requesting there, yeah.
Thank you.
So Tom is indicating that Virgin is giving deals on the service. And Serge Jarik says he's having Bell 5150 installed on Saturday. It's a Black Friday deal, $75 a month for 12 months instead of $105, no contract, and $100 cashback, but $60 activation, 150 megabits per second upload and download with a dedicated line.
So upload speeds of that are pretty impressive for sure if you got 150 upload.
Yeah.
Lawrence, one thing I'll point out on the Ease Us to do backup, that just watch for this, is that if you do file exclusions, basically you're defining a task anytime you do these things. If you define exclusions, if you decide that you want to modify the exclusion list, you have to create a new backup task job. It could still be going to the same folder and same file name and things like that. But yeah, it bothered me for a while because they were all grayed out. And it turns out that as soon as you click on yes, you're happy with this exclusion list, if you want to change that, you have to create a brand new task. So just watch for that.
Okay. Nope, that makes sense. I'm thinking of a solution that leaves behind blob files, binary large objects, so mainly recordings and pictures, yep, and so forth.
Yep. I exclude paging files, hibernation files, temp directories, cache directories, things like that. So it's definitely able to reduce the size of your backup sets.
And there was a hand just came up from Faber Ishel. You have a question?
Balance of the shooter bought the gun 3 days before. because he was too young to buy a gun. So his parents bought him the gun. He did it before that.
Not getting that, Chris.
No, I'm not either.
I think that's Fiat says she may have her microphone on by accident.
Nothing.
You said. Oh, Bialt muted herself, so I guess it was by accident.
I just muted.
Oh, okay.
The hand came up from Faber Ischel. But Faber Ischel is also muted on the iPad.
Yeah, so Faber Ischel, if you want to ask, if you can't get unmuted, if you wanted to ask it in the chat window, if you had your hand up.
Otherwise, we're just on time, I think. So let's do the wrap up and then we can come back if there's any last minute things.
Two people have their hands up, me and Serge. Serge Eddie.
Why don't you go ahead? Because I can't see your hand up.
Oh, it's up there, right there on the video.
Okay.
Anyway, I just wanted to share an app that I use. If people have an Android phone, or sorry, an Android watch, or a Wear OS watch, I should say. There's an app you can get for Android called Wear Battery Full. And what it does is it will tell you on your watch how your battery is charging when it is charging. And secondly, you can get an alarm at different percentages of fullness, as well as an alarm when you take your phone. Your watch off of charging. So I find that very useful. It's called Wear Battery Full.
Okay, thanks, cool. Tom. And can you put the link in the chat window so people can reference that? And in the meantime, Cédric, you have a question or a comment? You did.
He's muted. You're muted, Cédric.
Here we go.
There you go.
Just to come back, and the reason why I'm switching to Bell is because there was when I'm chatting with my computer from work, when I'm in MS Teams, it's very often it's interrupted, and I need a reliable line. And Bell Fabs offer a dedicated line, which means no interference from anybody else in your neighborhood, and no looping, how do you call that, when you try watching a video and then you cannot...
caching,
that's
yeah.
That's the reason why. Now, I have a share. At this time of the year, every year, major computer magazines in Germany offer free software. So for those interested, I'm going to put the links in. There's actually five sources, and Germany also has something, so we might be able to get maybe a 50-75% or even more, or sometimes a free recent software good for a year, and through those offerings.
Cool.
Thanks, Serge. Put the link in the chat window, please.
Lawrence, go ahead.
Okay. Serge, I was just going to make comment. For all the reasons that you said, yes, but do realize that if it's your wireless that is causing the hiccups, that will not improve. But I will say that the modem that comes with the fiber, and I forget the model number of it, but Chris had it in his picture when he was showing the various routers. It is a superior wireless wireless source, I guess is the right way to say it. I do notice that with my receivers, they are far better with their wireless now, even though it's in the far corner of my basement, than I did with my Eastlink modem from about 3 to 4 years ago. So, you know, there's that to be said. But if you're running into a wireless issue, and a lot of my colleagues, that is the biggest issue that they have, is that they have problems, and it doesn't matter what they get put in at their home internet. It is the wireless to their office that is the issue. And to Tristan, amen. Nothing beats a cable. And it's so hard to tell people that if you're having problems, well, plug it in and see if those problems continue. Only That's a couple right. people are willing to follow through on that piece of advice for various reasons.
Well, if you tell them that, you won't help them until they prove that it's not the wireless.
I don't have that option, but thank you for offering.
Thanks, Orange. I'm being offered the latest model of the modem, which just right. came up. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's the one that Chris had in his picture.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you, it is a better wireless experience than what I had with Eastlink. And the Eastlink modem was actually far closer than where the Bell is. So to me, that says something. Yeah. But, you know, you got to be always careful as to what is the network connection between your laptop and your router.
Yeah.
Newest is probably good. Tom, you still have a hand up. Do you want to say something else, or is that from previous?
Good night.
Okay. All right. So to wrap up, on Monday, December the 6th at 3:30 p.m., if you missed all the sessions, the previous Q&As that Bob Walker did on electronic books, he's doing a session for the Library Tech Cafe. I just remind you that you have to register with the library to get the login credentials for their Zoom session. So if you go to the link there, you can sign on for Bob's session on Monday. And then next Wednesday is our regular monthly meeting, the December meeting, and Tom is going to be talking about all things security, and in particular, how you can implement a number of different security layers on your system to try and give you maximum protection. And with that, I remind you that because next week is a regular meeting, there will not be a Q&A session following the December the 8th meeting. So our next Q&A will be on December the 15th. If you have questions or you want to share, now you know all about sharing, you want to share your favorite Windows or Android or anything else application, and send us a heads up to suggestion box, and we'll reserve you a slot. So thanks very much, everyone, and I think that's it for tonight.
Thanks, folks.